When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everybody. It's another Wednesday. Sawadee krap from Thailand. How's it going, Alex?
This is all very, very, very White Lotus. I feel this, the whole thing is deliberate. Also, I can't help but notice everything over your shoulder. There's a massage billboard. You've got you've got Chinese cuisine on the other side in Bangkok. Yeah. I don't know. It suits you. You're wearing your let's see, your soul mates.
Yeah, I mean, for those who are listening, it's a Korea hat to celebrate the amazing country of South Korea.
While he's sitting in Bangkok. But yeah, that makes sense. How is everything? How are you?
It's good. I love that you brought up White Lotus, because we just have to ask. We forgot to ask last week. Obviously, the most referenced TV show on air is the show White Lotus. And now I'm sure some of you guys know that season 3 has premiered. We were wondering, do you want us to discuss it? Do you want maybe at the end of every episode, our thoughts? No, every weekly podcast episode, our thoughts on the episode of the week kind of thing. If you do, let us know, because otherwise Alex doesn't want to watch it every week.
I'm on team no. Guys, write in to say that you don't want us to have that in the last 2 minutes of the episode. Not because it's not a great series, because I'm sure it will be, but because I'm not doing that whole watching one episode a week. It's the gap is too much. Let me know when the 5-6 episodes are on there, then I'll watch them kind of all in 1 week.
What happened to patience? You think about when our parents were young. They had to wait a whole week to watch it on TV with ads. We can at least watch it when we want, where we want. All we need to worry about is that we have to wait a week between episodes.
It's funny, because you say about our parents' generation and what they had to be patient for. My mum was telling me about, you know, how on a Friday, Friends, you know, waiting a full week one 20-minute episode of Friends, and that being the highlight of Friday night. And now everything is available to us on demand. We decide what we want, when we want. And we're lucky. Everything that we want is kind of, you know, just a click away.
Yeah, I think waiting a week is not a huge deal. And, you know, we're lucky to have it like we have it. Everything is at our fingertips. And also think about the days when in-flight entertainment, when it just started, when it was channels and you had to click through and you couldn't pause. The movie started wherever you joined it. I remember even when we were young, there were still some aircraft, British Airways, that had those, you know. I remember when we flew Virgin Atlantic and they had a preloaded selection where you could choose. This was 2004 or 5, and you didn't have to watch with everyone else. And I was just so mind blown by how high tech that system felt.
You're so right. I remember going back and forth to somewhere like Cyprus to see family as a kid, and on the old Cyprus Airways A330s, and you used to have like 5 channels, like a kids channel, drama, action, whatever. And as you say, everything on those channels started as soon as you became airborne, and it was up to you to find the channel and watch, and there was no rewinding, no going back. But the good thing is that if you did miss the first 15 minutes of the episode or the movie, once it finished, it would then automatically start again, so you could catch it then. And I mean, there was something beautiful in the simplicity of that, not knowing what really the movie was called, unless they had bothered to kind of put in a little movie info card in your seat pocket, and everyone watching. If there was a main thing, everyone watching the same thing at exactly the same time. I think I told you before, I remember watching the film Hachi, which is, I think Hachi or Hachiko, which was a film about a dog who always returned to the spot where the owner passed away. Do you know this?
Yeah, I just need to Google this, because I might have a very funny fact about that movie. Is that the one with Richard Gere? Yeah, Yeah, Hachi, yes. A dog tail. My uncle produced this movie.
You're a joke. What a film. What a film. Yeah. That was amazing. But the bit I remember specifically and about why it's relevant to aviation is that it's really emotional and really sad, I think, towards the end. I remember looking around and everyone together being really kind of sad and emotional, seeing a few people crying because you were all watching the film at exactly the same time, you know, on these old TVs on board.
And it's scientifically proven that you get more emotional on planes watching movies. So if I ever cry to a movie, it is on a flight, because something about it, you're just like, oh. I recently watched, there's this movie with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who I love. I don't even remember the name, but there's like a big parrot or something that represents death. And the movie wasn't very good, but I was still crying toward the end because she had such a powerful performance. And then you're just sitting on the plane, like hiding your face. I can't believe this is happening right now. But
there was definitely an article a few years ago. I think it could have been from GQ or someone like that. And it said, why do men cry on planes?
Yeah.
And it was about the study in which your emotions are massively heightened without you realizing on an aircraft in a pressurized cabin of an altitude above 30,000 feet. And as a result, your emotions kick in way more than they would on the ground. Hence why you get more people welling up at movies, for example, than you would if you were just sat in the cinema or at home.
And I also find that about reading, because I've really gotten into reading in the past 6 months, I guess. And on planes, like, I'm fine reading on the ground, but I don't get, like, I have a harder time binging. But on a flight, especially if I'm in the second half of a book, I just can't put it down. I'm like, oh my God, I have to read more, because somehow I get more engaged or more invested in the story when I'm on a flight.
See, this is where you owe it to the listeners to admit that the book that you're mentioning is in fact the in-flight menu that you just can't put down. You're just so invested and engaged.
I'm crying.
Emotional.
Some airlines I cry because the menu is good. Some airlines I cry because the menu is bad.
Speaking of crying because the menu is bad, what did you experience this week on board? Anything you'd like to share with the listeners, or are we going to have to wait?
There will be some interesting videos coming on my channel shortly, but for now, no comment. I need to talk to my lawyer, aka ChatGPT, before I say anything.
Guys, Dan texted me with quite a scenario. And of course, my first question was, okay, we're going to discuss all of this on the podcast, right? He said, not yet. Let him just sort out a few things post what he experienced. So, okay, it's pointless. I won't go any more into it. I'm glad that you're all right. And I am sat here on the side of the listeners waiting for the go-ahead to hear about what the hell happened to you this week. But let's instead move into some of the headlines as to what's been happening in the world of aviation, or rather what's not been happening, because everything continues to be happening. We've had near misses caught on 4K HD video camera again. And we've had different emergency landings that have also been documented on 4K HD cameras again. And it's just US aviation particularly can't seem to stop going viral, even though things like runway incursions or smoke in the cabin were happening and were happening at the same rate as they are now. It's just that it wasn't getting as much media attention. We can come to that a bit later, but specifically as we move into March, I wanted to talk about how the search for MH370 has resumed for the first time in 10 years. MH370 is, of course, probably a household name as a flight number to most people, remembering that this is still today the missing Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 that was flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. And we know very little about its whereabouts. There were 200 plus lives on board, and the search involved multiple countries, including Australia, including, of course, Singapore itself, and Thailand were involved, China were involved, Malaysia, and still the whereabouts, I mean, there's very little known. We've had a little bit of debris wash up on the likes of Madagascar and places like that. Nothing very, very definitive. And so the search was called off. And here we are now, so many years later, over 10 years later, and the search is now going to recommence. So to give some context, and then I'll get your thoughts on this, right? The Malaysian government has engaged with Ocean Affinity. Have you seen or heard of this company before?
Well, anyone who's followed MH370 should be familiar with this name, because as far as I understand, back in 2018, they were also searching for the debris. It's just that now they have a different search area. They're more confident. We can go into the details of the search shortly. The thing that's interesting here is that this company will not make any money from doing this unless they find the wreckage. So this was the deal last time in 2018. They obviously didn't find it, so they made no money. Now they're giving it another try. And if they're successful, the Malaysian government will pay $70 million as a reward, basically, which, you know, considering the time and the effort that is going into finding this, I find in perhaps a surprisingly small amount. But hopefully, I think, you know, this is also good PR for them to try to do this, especially if they're successful. So, yes, fingers crossed.
So this aircraft that went missing on the 8th of March, as Dan said, in 2014, where Malaysia had suffered those two awful tragedies, a few months later, of course, MH17, another 777, was shot down by pro-Russian separatists, and it was shot down from just across the border into Ukraine. But with MH370, with 239 on board, this new search, as Dan said, no find, no fee, meaning there's no real loss for the Malaysia government here, is going to take place in a new 15,000 square kilometer area with improved deep sea scanning technology that is undoubtedly going to offer better detection capabilities than where we were, for example, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. If we just think about how much the world has changed in the last 5 years in terms of technology and development, and, you know, 5 years ago, it's very unlikely that you would have heard us throw around the term AI, for example, and now it's worked into every sentence. We've definitely unlocked new capabilities, and I think this is part of the reasoning behind. I've spoken to some of the guys who were involved in the Malaysia search the first time round that went on for several years. That was the initial search between 2014 and 2017. That didn't involve Ocean Affinity and was a far more traditional kind of manual search, if you like, where they were basically looking for floating debris. And they said that in terms of how everything has changed and how the world has developed since then, they were quite confident that a much more concentrated, modern search was the answer to finding some definitive answers as to what happened, and hopefully therefore providing closure for the families, because this is who they're doing it for. So where are they going to search? The area is in the southern Indian Ocean. It's about 2,000 kilometers west of Perth, Australia. And the zone is based on particular and specifically refined drift analysis consistent with drift patterns from debris that they have found and debris that they expect to maybe be in that area. It's been using updated satellite area. There are different stakeholders involved, once again, that are companies that didn't exist prior to in the initial search. And this is all based on the knowledge that the last known whereabouts of MH370 was in what's known as the seventh arc, which is when you look at the kind of the where the pings, and I'm for those that are listening and not seeing us, I was kind of gesturing there, but the last known ping from MH370, which was essentially like a handshake, a tiny moment where the aircraft via its satellite data is informing the likes of Inmarsat, who are a massive leader in this area in satellite technology, telecommunications, and so on. It's like a little handshake. It's like a ping, I'm here, for a split second. The last known handshake was in that seventh arc in the southern Indian Ocean. And they're using that to then calculate all these years later where they think ultimately the bulk of the debris will have stopped based on drift patterns and everything there. So initially, when I had seen that they were going to be putting in this effort once again for the first time since 18, my first thoughts were, of course, that I hope that they get some answers, if only for the families. And then, of course, because it continues to be aviation's greatest mystery.
Yeah, it just, if they manage to find it, that will be truly an accomplishment for all of humanity, because you think about how vast this ocean is, how many years it's been. Presumably, there will be debris scattered across thousands of miles, and there won't really be, you know, a huge piece of wreckage left. I see someone here comparing to doing some calculations, basically saying that the wreckage, if there is a full wreckage of a 777, which we know there isn't at this point, even that in the context of this ocean would be like looking for a grain of sand in Manhattan, and it's underwater. So you have a boat scouring basically Manhattan looking for one grain of sand, but it's thousands of feet down. I just don't see how that can be possible. But if they find it, it's truly amazing to get answers. At this point, the question, you know, it's really for the families and for the aviation community as a whole to figure out what happened here. But, you know, it's not like at this point, this is information that will be life-changing in any way for the industry, you know, going forward, perhaps.
No, I mean, perhaps, yeah, maybe you're referring to, for example, lessons or us discovering something about the 777 or anything. No, I think you're right. I don't think we're going to get anything of that with the discovery, for example, of wreckage. But I do think it would, as we say, it would just close a chapter as to how does the world lose a 777 and not find it, you know? And as you say, we're looking for a grain of sand in somewhere the size of Manhattan, but still tell that to a person who says, who looks at a 777, sees a massive, you know, heavy aircraft and thinks, how on earth does that just simply fly off and never get seen again or have its whereabouts, you know, never discovered?
Yeah. It's crazy to think about. It's a scary thought. And you just hope that, you know, in 2025, that isn't a possibility. But sometimes, I mean, if I'm going to be honest, the thing that I still worry about the most from a safety perspective when it comes to flying, I'm sure you're the same, is the pilots and their mental health. Because I trust the plane, I trust the systems. Although we've seen air traffic control isn't always perfect, I trust that. Of course, turbulence doesn't concern me, but specifically, there are humans at the end of the day with emotions going through things that are, you know, controlling the aircraft. So if there is one thing I'm worried about, and I think this is, you know, what everything points to in the case of MH370, it's that a pilot is in control and can ultimately choose to complete a flight safely or not. And now, of course, since especially the Eurowings incident where we had a pilot basically commit suicide by crashing the plane into a mountain, there are some more safety systems in place, like most airlines and regions not allowing a pilot to be in the cockpit alone. But still, that's you know, that's the thing about MH370 that still kind of haunts me.
No, you're right, and there were so many measures that were put into place, not really after MH370, but as you say, after the German Wings accident, which was of course the former name of what is now Eurowings, part of the Lufthansa group. I guess in that scenario, as you said, when people ask us and they say, you know, are you worried about this or are you worried about that, I think it is sensible, your analysis on it is, I am far more concerned about whether or not the flight crew had a good night's sleep, or as we've said before, or if he's going through any stress, or if she's going through a divorce, or, you know, something like this, things that put strain on a human to then manage such a high workload, you know, responsible environment as is the case for air traffic controllers, as is the case for those that are refueling or you know, providing maintenance to the aircraft as well during the ground time and all that.
But
no, you're right.
You know, this, I feel, just is an interesting segue into something we weren't initially going to discuss, but I just think it's relevant and kind of interesting now, because in the past week, on Sunday, there was also a close incident in San Francisco involving an Asiana A350 that is eerily reminiscent of what happened in 2013 when an Asiana 777 was coming in too low, too slow in San Francisco and ended up crashing. So on Sunday, there was an Asiana A350 approaching San Francisco, and it ended up getting about 275 feet over the water, which was a third of the altitude it was supposed to be at. And the way this relates to our discussion, and the thing that I think a lot of people find so mind-blowing, is there were three pilots in the cockpit. How is it possible that an A350 operating an international long-haul flight is so off course? The weather was apparently not bad from what I've read. So something is off here. And again, it makes me wonder, we've seen in Asia, which it is my favorite region in the world, you feel very safe there, but the fact is that the cultures are very hierarchical and the seniority is everything. So perhaps, again, this points to issues we've seen over and over, especially a few decades ago in Asia, where the captain is doing something and the other pilots on board don't dare to question it out of cultural standards or norms. So then you don't have these redundancy systems in place with multiple pilots to see that something's going wrong, because even if they see that something is up, they don't necessarily feel comfortable voicing that concern.
And to think that this is the exact same location that Asiana suffered that massive crash because of a similar kind of error coming in far too low at the same airport. I don't know if it was the same runway. It sounds like it's probably one of them on that side.
It is the same runway, yeah.
Yeah, so the same runway, same airport at San Francisco, and it was a massive Boeing 777 accident because of kind of similar contributors involving the same airline. You would think that it would, you know, out of everywhere that they land. I don't know, if I'm a pilot, I feel like that's going to cross my mind every time I come into SFO flying for the same airline that had that massive, massive accident.
Exactly. And then again, I guess we're going to stop talking about incidents after this.
But we owe it to, I know, because we never used to discuss it this much.
No.
But the thing is, we owe it to the listeners to provide context, right? To give our thoughts on this, but also to just kind of help make sense of it, because when we don't, all anyone is left with is what the mainstream clickbaity, you know, the all of the big legacy networks now are obsessed with covering commercial aviation, because they know it is freaking you out with every single upload. And now there are even articles based on the back of everything the media are doing, like the New York Times or whoever it was a couple of days ago, you know, is flying safe anymore?
And
because they've fed you so much about what's happened in the last week, and then that so much so that they're now coming up with new content based on the content they've already pushed out, questioning, you know, well, now we've told you all this, is it even safe for you to step on board?
Exactly. So that brings us to the final incident we'll be talking about today. And again, it relates back to the pilots at the end of the day, because this incident occurred on Tuesday, the 25th. So yesterday at Chicago Midway. Middle of the day, beautiful day in Chicago.
Good weather.
Good visibility. And what happens is we have a flex jet, a private jet, a Bombardier Challenger that's been cleared to taxi to the runway 22 left for takeoff.
Yeah.
And they're specifically told twice by the tower to hold short of runway 31 center because there's a Southwest 737 landing there. They, of course, air traffic control doesn't inform the jet that there's a Southwest 737 landing, because hold short of runway 31 center is enough. Yet the pilots,
and just to put that into simple terms, in case anyone's unfamiliar with hold short, basically imagine a crossroads okay? You're at the crossroads. There is going to be a car coming and crossing on the right, and therefore, because it's going to be crossing in front of you, you have traffic lights, you've got a red light there. You don't question whether or not you should ignore the red light because there's no car coming from the right. You know that the red light is there because the ones from the right are going to be passing in front of you. This is the exact same thing. They've told the smaller aircraft to hold short, basically stay there. That's the air traffic control equivalent of a red light. And it's not for them to ask why. It is because, of course, a big Southwest 737 is about to land on the runway that they are about to cross over. So they need to wait until the aircraft has landed and passed them.
Good explanation. So the part where the pilot error comes in here is that the Flexjet aircraft does not stop. They don't even seem to look to the right before they start taxiing across the runway, which if they did, they would see a Southwest 737 feet from touching down, just a few hundred meters down the runway. So luckily, these incredible pilots at Southwest, in a nose-up position, because when an aircraft comes into land, they need to flare to smooth out the touchdown and hit the runway as nicely as possible. But what that means is that the nose is up, and you have quite bad visibility down the runway. But even at that point, the pilots manage to see that there's an aircraft coming into the runway and starting to cross. So they initiate a go-around, take off again, basically, and basically ask air traffic control, what was that? Air traffic control doesn't need to give an explanation because it wasn't their fault in this case. But again, literally seconds from catastrophe in the United States. And it's just
seconds from another collision in just weeks, had it not have been, you know, the right call of the Southwest flight crew to be able to very quickly initiate a go around. You know, thank God aircraft land at a very similar speed to the likes that they rotate on and they depart on as well. And that's, you know, part of the fundamentals of flying.
But exactly. The crazy thing about Chicago Midway specifically, actually, this is kind of reminiscent of DCA, Washington Reagan Airport as well. It's a downtown city airport with all these convoluted intersecting runways and taxiways. If you think about the big airports of the world, London Heathrow, JFK, Doha, Dubai, all of these airports have very clearly separated runways that are not intermingled with all the terminals that require you to cross them to get to the runway you're going to take off from, for example. But Chicago Midway is basically a square with runways intersecting in all directions and taxiways on top of that. And in addition, it's an incredibly busy airport. There are thousands of movements here per week. It's a huge hub for Southwest Airlines. So of course it's a complicated place to operate and keep track of things, which means it's even more important for pilots to be alert, let alone when they're taxiing over an active runway. So thank goodness the Southwest pilots, you know, managed to avert catastrophe here.
Yeah, kudos to them. Thank God for that, because you know, the US can't seem to catch a break, as we've spoken about over the last few weeks. And of course, a lot of it, as I say, is not that the rate of weird, you know, near misses or runway incursions is increasing, but it's because we seem to be capturing. I mean, this video footage, was it a plane spotter? I didn't check.
Imagine if they had caught this live and people are watching.
God. That would have been awful. Well, speaking of live streaming, I mean, this is the era that airlines are having to prepare for now, because I was looking at some updated crisis stuff that airlines are issued by regulators and associations like IATA, and there are new considerations for them in terms of how they respond to a crisis, knowing that many of their aircraft, as we move into, you know, this new era of tech that is available in the market, like Starlink, are able to be completely connected, changing the dynamic of when we find out about things or how things on board are captured and so on. A little segue into how AirBaltic have become the first airline in Europe to begin its rollout of SpaceX's Starlink Wi-Fi. This is the ultra high-speed Wi-Fi that is gate-to-gate, meaning it's as soon as you board until you arrive. It's low latency. It enables streaming, gaming, everything. I mean, I have experienced it now well over 6 or 7 times, and Starlink is just faster Wi-Fi than I have even at home, and I've got the fastest package that you can buy. So it's really, really, really impressive stuff. I think the unique little thing about it coming on AirBaltic, and of course we have Martin on, didn't we, on the podcast, is that most of their flights, like most European flights, are not very long at all. And so it's nice for that continuity, that there won't be that hour break, you know, where typically, okay, if you're flying in the morning and it's, you know, it's a working day and you're in touch with everyone, and then you're kind of not contactable for an hour or so. That now is no longer the case if you choose airlines like AirBaltic, where you can stay in touch. Is there so much of a need on short haul as there is on long haul? I don't know. I think sometimes it's nice to switch off for 50 minutes, but it's about exercising the choice. Right now you have the choice. You don't have to connect.
Yeah, I just find this a very interesting choice for AirBaltic of all airlines, because they, first of all, are in a geographic location and a position at the moment where they're, you know, the competitive landscape for them is a bit different. They're, of course, kind of a hybrid low-cost airline. So for them to be offering free high-speed Wi-Fi, I don't know if this is something that will necessarily make people choose them over the competition, because they're not that type of airline. So it's interesting. Of course, it's a nice benefit, but...
It will just enhance the existing passenger experience on AirBaltic, right? Rather than have me go out of my way to choose to fly with AirBaltic. But specifically on the free part, it is my understanding, and of course I haven't seen the contract between SpaceX and AirBaltic, but it is my understanding that Starlink must be offered for free to passengers. Mm. This is a quiet contractual requirement from SpaceX, a company of Elon Musk. And so when I see airlines throwing about how, and it's going to be free, and it's going to be free, I'm like, well, I think you kind of have no choice.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Elon Musk thinks he'll make the money back from people watching, being on Twitter or something. But
maybe.
It is kind of crazy. I mean, Starlink, of course, is an amazing thing, and it's exciting that airlines are introducing it. It is kind of crazy now that we
didn't experience it yet, right?
No, I haven't. I was just going to say, quick comment, that it's kind of crazy that we have this amazing invention that people are celebrating from someone who's now a neo-Nazi. It just feels kind of bizarre, but that's where we are. So there's no alternative to SpaceX at the moment. Starlink. Sorry. Anyway.
Well, it is. I mean, look, your comment is valid in that many airlines are quietly having discussions in the room as to just how much they link it with SpaceX or link it with Elon because of the way that things are panning out in US politics and the seemingly questionable role that he has. That all, you know, this is the subject of US politics daily now. They don't quite understand, or this email that he sent where he needed every federal employee to reply, and then other big states like bigger federal agencies like the State Department inform their staff, you don't owe Elon Musk any explanation. I don't know, it's all a bit messy. We won't get into it, but you're right, it has caused a question mark as to what extent airlines want to promote the company or technology of someone who is increasingly controversial and also questionable in many of his views currently.
Yeah, I mean, just think about an airline like SAS or even Air France now that have both committed to install it. They operate in markets that are presumably extremely against Elon Musk and his beliefs at this point. So I do think you're right that there will be a bit of a balance here when it comes to how airlines present it. And, you know, even last year, before the election, I think airlines were very excited to say Elon Musk's SpaceX Starlink.
Yeah.
But now it's going to be a bit more like, we have amazing fast Wi-Fi from Starlink, period. Statement ends
yes,
there.
Yes, yes, you're right. It's definitely less affiliated or less associated with him in much of the commentary related to airlines that are launching. There's so many in the queue now. Air France, SAS, United, there yeah. are many. United had a good advert, which I liked, which, you know, many of the focus for some airlines about why it will be a benefit to have Starlink on board has focused on gamers. There's been a lot of focus on, and I'm like...
Which is so random.
I've never seen a gamer on a commercial flight. Like, I just haven't. It's really random. But United did show, okay, I think they did show someone gaming, but they did nicely show a Ring doorbell going off and then someone just discreetly saying, hey, you can just leave it by the plant pot. And I thought, that is cool, because I've done that on existing Wi-Fi, not Starlink Wi-Fi. And that was, you know, that was handy so that you don't miss a delivery, especially if you're on the way to the destination where they're delivering. So the real life examples is that the real world stuff is the stuff that that I like. I wanted to get your thoughts on how this awful, never-ending 20, 30-year debate on whether or not they should expand Heathrow. We're not going to go into that, but how the Emirates CEO, or rather the Emirates president, Tim Clark, has said that there will be legal challenges if Heathrow even consider increasing landing fees for airlines in order to pay and fund an expanded Heathrow, either an additional runway or expanded terminals and so on. Many of these airlines that you think would be pro-expansion are not when it comes to Heathrow, because they know that they are probably going to end up paying for it. I mean, ask BA itself. Does BA want an expanded Heathrow? And they're very kind of, well, you know, economic growth is good for the UK, but because even they don't want, they see an expanded Heathrow as extra competition. And they think, no, we've got it all right at the moment. We're dominant. So why would they want to welcome others? They also know that, as with most projects in the UK, it's just increasingly and incredibly messy over recent years. You know, I think back to a time where the UK were able to build things like bridges and malls and things like that, and then just think about the last time they built a bridge or they opened a solid piece of infrastructure that benefited the public. And I can't, because it's just been a mess of so many years. Look at all the money they have spent on high speed, can't remember if it's high speed one or high speed two, the high speed rail project that they just, we'll just put on the shelf after spending multi millions on nothing now because they're not continuing it with it. And then you think, okay, of course, if you're an airline CEO, you're thinking, hold on a minute, by their track record in the UK now, if they are going to genuinely move ahead with expanding, don't come to us with expanded landing fees and a new look at making Heathrow even more expensive. What do you think?
It's so interesting thinking about, first of all, this perspective that many airlines don't want expansion at Heathrow, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Of course, for Emirates, they're in a kind of tricky situation, because right now they might be fine when they have the A380. But if you think 20 years down the line, perhaps then an expanded Heathrow would be good for them, because I could see hourly flights between Dubai and London on a 777X or something. The other thing is that, you know, especially at certain times of year, flights already aren't full from Heathrow as it is. So, you know, there's the need for additional expansion is a future thing, maybe not a current thing. So for maybe it's short-sighted of British Airways, for example, to be against expansion at Heathrow, because as hopefully
they say that
the
they're
UK
not like
grows,
BA say they're not against. I mean, at one point they were. They say that they're no longer against, but that it, you know, they're very, very kind of indifferent about it. They're okay, but you know, it should, you know, don't cause a mess, basically.
Yeah, I guess perhaps BA is the one airline that sort of benefits in both scenarios. Now they benefit because they can charge higher prices and control most of the market. If it expands, they'll benefit from being able to increase their presence and frequencies. But I mean, I think that there will be a lot of pushback from airlines if any expansion, or first of all, if fees are raised. But the question is, if they raise fees, what happens if there is no expansion? Because it's easy to raise the fees, but it's less easy to go through with the very controversial runway.
You're right. Did you consider what would happen to the terminal setup at Heathrow in an expanded Heathrow environment? So if they expanded Heathrow, what would happen? From my understanding, Terminal 3 would be gone. That would be no more, right? So it would join the likes of Terminal 1 in becoming extinct. No word on what happens to 4. I have not seen any documentation. Someone can send it to me if they can find it, as to what happens to T4. In this explainer that I had read, Terminal 4 was just not even mentioned. It's really the forgotten terminal on the other side of runway. And even though it's home to many of the big players. Anyway, and then you would have a kind of more satellite kind of looking things from Terminal 2, so that your main terminals become like T5 and its satellites and T2 and its satellites, and the tunnels are already there ready to be carved out and built to expand things like the Heathrow Express. And you know, all this infrastructure was put into place knowing that one day Heathrow is going to have to grow. It's Britain's only genuine hub.
Yeah, and one so interesting thought I had at BKK the other day, just for the first time, I've never really thought about what is the reason for having multiple terminals. Besides, you know, at Heathrow, you have British Airways terminal. It makes everything easier for their passengers. But ultimately, a big reason to separate things is that at a certain point, one terminal, which is what BKK has, just becomes too crowded because now they've opened their satellite terminal. But even with that, the check-in area is still the same. So they've increased capacity by a huge amount. They've also opened a third runway, but there's no separate check-in or drop-off area, which means that now the departure hall is a zoo. It's so, so busy before people start dispersing toward their respective gates, which is, you know, makes everything a bit more chaotic, less pleasant. So that's a reason to, you know, chop things up a bit and make separate terminals where people drop off at separate places, they check in at separate places, etc.
Well, speaking of, separate terminals, Paris Charles de Gaulle just entered the chat with a few million terminals for a handful of airlines. And that's also not the beating heart of efficiency. No. I was just there recently the other day, and that scam, by the way, when you get out of a car at the drop-off for departure is still rife. So basically, I don't know if I spoke, we did speak about it, right? Whether there is a guy waiting with a trolley, pretending he's an official porter, ready to take the luggage and then either walk off with it or demand a ridiculous amount of money for helping you with your bags, not to be made eye contact with, and just keep your belongings with you, stay vigilant. That's not just a message for Paris, but that's everywhere in Europe at the moment and so many other areas of the world too.
Yeah.
Shall we move in to Q&A?
Let's do it. So Andreas wrote me last night asking, what are your thoughts on the changes to Miles and More for the podcast? So let's briefly talk about this, because Lufthansa Group keeps delighting us with their innovations. And especially the upsetting thing I feel is that Lufthansa Group always manages to find a way to gaslight or make every negative change try to seem like something good instead of just being honest with their customers. Because yesterday, I got an email in my inbox saying, exciting changes to your award flights from June 2025 from Lufthansa Miles and More. And then you think, oh, that's cool. So then they say, look forward to flexible mileage amounts and a greater choice of fares with Austrian Airlines, Lufthansa, Lufthansa City, and Swiss. Which, of course, for me, where loyalty programs are a huge part of my job, that immediately is a red flag. It's not something exciting. And the specific implications of what Lufthansa is doing here to their loyalty program is they're going to be almost exactly tying the points price of a ticket to the cash fare. But that also will result in that they're going to mirror the different fare classes. So they currently have, you know, economy light, regular economy, economy flex. There will now be points options for each of those, meaning that while previously any points ticket would be more flexible, it would include luggage, all that stuff. Now the cheapest point ticket, which will probably not be much cheaper than the existing cheapest points ticket,
right,
will be a light fare that basically includes nothing. No seat selection, nothing, no luggage, all of that. Then they also state, you have to click through to the link where they go more into detail about what these changes mean. And they're very clear about, for example, first class costs more. It's a very exclusive offering. So expect to pay a lot more than you currently pay for first class. Yada, yada. Same thing for business class. The really negative thing here, besides that, is that they will still continue to limit the number of seats you can book with points. So the points price will now mirror cash, but they won't even give their members the benefit of being able to book every seat, whatever the price, as we see now with Virgin Atlantic, for example, using their points. Yeah. So their customers end up getting the worst of both worlds, much higher prices for the seats people want in premium cabins, less flexibility and less inclusions if they choose to book the cheap fare. And then on top of that, they'll also continue to be limited in the seats they can book. So Lufthansa here just being Lufthansa, saying it's an exciting change, but completely destroying their already bad loyalty program, which is sad to see. I think we've said a bunch of times that Lufthansa has a way too dominant position in the markets it and its group airlines operate in. But I guess we shouldn't be surprised, because Lufthansa is really at the now the leader of the race to the bottom in Europe in almost every aspect. So,
and whenever an airline tells you that you should be excited about it, is usually the biggest red flag ever.
Yeah, I mean, no airline is really ever going to have positive news when it comes to their loyalty programs these days, because they're all devaluing. But at least be honest about it. Say, you know, as a reflection of the current loyalty program market, we are making this change, blah, blah, blah.
Just be real.
Yeah, just be real. People will be upset regardless. But now it's just so, I don't know. I just hate it. I'm so disappointed, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Well, good. A good explainer. Got a question here, or rather, actually, it's an answer to a question we asked last week. So he says, "Hi, Alex. I prefer to be anonymous with this being mentioned on the pod. The reason for the flights being the flight schedules being changed at Bangalore. Remember, you were asking this, and you couldn't understand in last week's episode." Was because of the military air show in the nearby airbase. It caused many flight disruptions, mainly timing changes. I suppose that because of poor organization and communication, because it's a government event, he says, the airport and therefore airlines weren't informed properly of the timings. Personally, such events should be reduced if they then go on to cause such big disruptions to regular passengers. But it certainly isn't a regular thing at Bangalore Airport. But that's a great answer as to why you were noticing those the changes over that week specifically, wasn't it? So
good.
So that explains that. Thank you very much for getting in touch with that. Alma has been in touch and says, "Hi, Alex, currently listening to this week's podcast. Great as usual. I have a question for you both. After being influenced by Dan, my boyfriend and I decided to try our first airport lounge. It was the Sky Lounge in Vienna Airport, and we were super disappointed. There were no windows, clattering plates, loud staff, and the saddest lemon slices I've ever seen in my life. It was like being in a pub, to be honest. What good airport lounges would you recommend in Europe, which are accessible on a lower budget or open to all classes? And what is the worst you guys have ever visited? Thanks for the great work." I feel we have always been real, right, about how most lounges, for specifically in Europe, are what you have just described, Alma. They are a sad state of affairs with no windows and staff pushing a trolley and shouting to another staff and other people's leftovers everywhere. Unfortunately, that is the reality in so many, specifically third-party lounges, that if you had asked us, you know, hey guys, should I spend this amount of money to access the Sky Lounge in Vienna? Both Dan and I would have said no. We would have said, go for a nice dinner at your destination instead. You know, go to a restaurant that you otherwise wouldn't have gone to. Do not pay for that kind of experience. What do you think? Her specific question is, well, firstly, she says she was influenced by you. So this is all your fault, Dan.
Secondly,
what good airport lounges are accessible and open to all classes? You know, ones that you can pay to enter that are decent in Europe.
Well, look, Vienna Airport, my association with it is that the entire terminal smells like smoke and anything with the name Sky Lounge, whatever, Vienna Airport, I would be like, avoid.
Yeah. Panorama Lounge. I'm like, run.
Yeah. Honestly, anything with the word lounge in its name, I think you want to avoid, right? Like, it needs to just have a plain name, like whatever, you know, Al Safwa or something.
Come on, we're talking Europe, we're talking, you know,
okay. Listen, Platinum Wing, the Platinum Wing in Helsinki, again, not lounge, wing, the galleries. wait.
The Concord Pier in Hong Kong.
Yeah, Concord Room. It's those things.
Yeah.
Lufthansa First Class Terminal. so no.
Okay, look. But you're not buying your way into these. She's speaking about the accessible ones before something like an EasyJet flight or another airline that you don't have status on in order to make it a bit more comfortable. Plaza Premium in Europe are good.
Mm, yeah, they are. But then you'll usually end up having to wait in line, maybe even register beforehand because some of them have gotten so busy. And I think this is the problem with all these priority pass lounge key lounges in pretty much everywhere. In Asia, it's even worse. Although those lounges are incredible, the line will be 100 people long. They're too popular now and the quality has declined as a result.
Has fallen off of a cliff. That is true for most airport lounges, including the elite business class lounges that are specifically for airlines. You know, there's so many. Dan knows. I probably don't eat in about 95% of them just because, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. The food's been under a hot lamp for 8 hours. It's like the leftover edges of a quiche or what's supposed to be a quiche. And it's like, avoid.
Yeah, it's actually so bad. So, to be honest, the lounge experience is not something I, you know, recommend seeking out when it comes to most airlines. We've spoken about this before, how buy a nice meal in the terminal. If you have to, buy priority security, for example. Gatwick is a situation where they sell it super cheap, but it will make a huge difference. You'll get through quick. You find a quiet gate or somewhere to eat, or you find a restaurant. But I just think that airline lounges are not worth it. No, airport lounges. Some airline lounges are, but other airport
lounges. Some airline lounges are worth it. Yeah, yeah. But
are
other
not
airport
worth
lounges.
Seeking out at all. No. It's not a quiet, calm place to relax anymore.
No.
Airports all have free Wi-Fi nowadays. Most airports have charging, you know, around the terminals.
Yeah.
So just it. I would say invest in other parts like priority security. Perhaps check business class fares. For example, British Airways are often quite affordable within Europe if you book in advance to book their Club Europe. And then you'll get some of the other benefits that might be a bit more enjoyable than the windowless, disgusting food lounge, you know?
I think on behalf of the listeners, I think we're really grateful, Dan, that you have just texted me to say that you will be reimbursing Alma for her lounge experience because you owe it to her. That's really nice. You're a good person, Dan.
Well, okay, bleep. I don't know what to say about this, but I am sorry if I have led you into thinking that lounges
She was inspired by, you know, the probably the experiences of decent lounges, not knowing that the majority of them are not like that, especially the airlines that have got a, you know, we are the airport lounge for, and then there's a list of 100 airlines. Trust me, it's better outside. Better outside in the terminal.
Yeah, this brings me back to Sofia Airport when I was doing my Lufthansa Allegris thing. But from Sofia to Munich, their lounge is used by every single airline, Qatar, Fly Dubai, everyone that flies there, even the premium ones.
Yeah.
It's literally in a basement. Half the lounge is smoking. So there's like a full-on door that leads you into the smoking section. It feels horrible. It is horrible. So yeah, just I would honestly rather sit in the terminal in those cases. Final question here. I have one from Joe. He says, I heard recently that Emirates is adding more routes. Yes, this came out, I think, this week, which is exciting
news. Yes, earlier this week. Yeah, because it's kind of that plan. Yeah,
Emirates is not the airline to really ever announce new routes. It feels like they expand so, so conservatively. So part of that included Shenzhen, Hangzhou, and Chengdu in China this year. And
where the pandas are.
Exactly. And he wanted to ask my and your opinion, since there's a surge for capacity for China routes, why would Emirates actually cancel plans to resume A380 flights to Shanghai this year, since this is the busiest international hub in mainland China? Best podcast ever. Love listening to it every week. Thank you. Thanks, Joe. I thought this expansion was very surprising. What did you think?
I think that it's interesting that China is continuing to emerge as just a reliable, solid market, not just in aviation, but for example, I was just reading a Financial Times piece on how it is really the only luxury shopping market that the rest of the world is banking on, and the trend is trending upwards across so many different sectors in everything that involves spending, and air travel, of course, falls within that. And so I think when you're looking at the state of play globally, we can see that there is increasing demand specifically on passengers who are taking trips out of China and to the rest of the world. High spenders going on big trips, longer trips, perhaps a whole, you know, a multi-stop Europe trip to the US and so on. And therefore, I understand why, if you are in corporate planning at an airline and you are assessing the lucrative routes that are going to be the money makers over the next 5 years, assuming there is not some sudden, you know, global recession or pandemic or anything like that, you know, global shock, then I would continue to bet on China, given that all of the data shows that it is the safer bet to make. And it's amazing how huge China is, how many massive cities there are that are incredibly developed, and yet still it is incredibly underserved by almost all airlines globally. And therefore, in order to expand beyond just the household names, if you like, of Shanghai and of course Beijing, then you really need to be in those cities where there is a lot happening and there is a lot of growth, young population, big business, big tech, and just a heavy, heavy demand.
Yeah, well, I think the interesting part of this is that although there is obviously a lot of demand to and from China, it's an incredibly low yield market. If you check the prices on most of those routes, and by the way, all these routes are currently already served from Dubai to China by Chinese carriers. If you check the prices, they are rock bottom. If you're flying to or from Dubai from Asia, you will find fares for less than $1,000 on most Chinese carriers. So that's why I find this slightly puzzling for a premium airline like Emirates. I think they see a lot of cargo capacity, which makes it appealing, because obviously there's, you know, Shenzhen, for example, most Apple products are shipped from. So that's one thing. Chengdu has lots of trading and stuff. So that's probably a consideration. I'm sure they will have very low fees and costs operating to China as well. So it will be interesting to see
how they perform. And also, not forgetting that It is the expectation that Chinese carriers won't be able to continue what they're doing now, which is dumping capacity into the market with unsustainably, you know, low fares. They're doing that everywhere in order to compete. And they're, of course, heavily subsidized. Most of the time, they're fully state-owned. And therefore, they're able to really, really, really undercut these airlines in order to bring down the fares for everyone. And therefore, it's become a low-yield operation. Everyone I've spoken to says that's not sustainable. Those fares will increase. And understandably, you know, airlines want to make their move and be in the competitive market that China is continuing to offer them, because despite, with everything that you have outlined, demand continues to increase. It still requires capacity. And so long as it requires additional capacity, expansion is the only way forward.
Yeah, I think if we do see Chinese airlines lower fares eventually, India will be the new market that is offering low fares. They already kind of are, but once IndiGo starts operating more long haul, I think that will kind of replace this. But the second part of the question is why they would cancel plans to resume A380 flights to Shanghai. I just think that comes down to Shanghai being a very competitive market. You have almost every European airline flying there. So for Emirates, that's a bit different, because here from Shenzhen, Chengdu, etc., they can connect people to most of Europe, Africa, the US. Well, the US would be a bit of a detour, but they can do that with one stop, versus from Shanghai, there's a ton of one stop options that you don't really have out of these other cities. So that's why I think it makes sense.
And there are massive, massive traffic flows of across the continent of Africa to China and across all the different cities via somewhere like the Middle East, which sits perfectly in between. So it's definitely continuing to be, that pattern existed way before, you know, we're talking 10 years ago, but it's something that has continued to mature as time has gone on.
Yeah. And also just lastly, I think, why are we seeing Emirates expansion announced now, especially such a big one? Although it hasn't been officially announced in like a press release, right? It's just through the grapevines. But because Emirates is finally receiving new aircraft for the first time in ages. So this is what's enabling this. We also have Helsinki, Da Nang, and a couple African cities, like in the Kinshasa, I think.
Kinshasa was one,
all of those cities surprise me, to be honest. I'm really surprised by Helsinki. Da Nang, from what I hear, also, I think the African cities on Da Nang, there's no mention of these being direct flights. And Emirates, they already have a few, you know, tag on Fifth Freedom flights. For example, they do Singapore, Phnom Penh. I think Da Nang will be a similar situation.
Da Nang is probably a candidate.
Perhaps these African cities as well. Helsinki, I don't understand. I don't see what is going on there, because Finnair is already, you know, often not very full on that route. So we'll see.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
We shall. I do have quite a few more questions. I've got questions from Lucy. I've got questions from Ziad. I have questions from Suhaim. Marco, I'll put them on the list. We'll make sure that we get to them next week. They're already there. One of them, I'm ready with the answer. So we'll start with that next week. Thank you for joining us as always. And remember that you can listen to On Air with Dan and Alex wherever you get your podcast. That includes Spotify, Apple, YouTube, where you can see us in vision. If you haven't rated the podcast yet, we would be most grateful for your 5-star ratings. And the best way for other people to find out about the podcast is basically to share it via word of mouth. Sharing this episode with your friend and saying you should listen to these guys because they are giving nice context on, and then fill in the blank, because boy, we discuss a lot in an hour, some relevant, some not so relevant.
Yeah, we are giving nice context on why the Sky View Lounge or whatever in Vienna
is windowless and should be avoided.
Lemon slices. Yeah.
Yes, and lemon slices are so important. All right, we'll catch you guys next week.
We will see you then on air. Bye-bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.